This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside our area, please call 877-217-5757. You may reach us via email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Legendary actor Richard Burton is probably best remembered for a couple of things, being nominated 6 times for the Academy Award for Best Actor and never winning, and being married twice to Elizabeth Taylor. Now the Tony Award-winning actor's diaries have been published in the United States by Yale University. Editor Chris Williams is with us, and like Richard Burton, Chris is from Wales, and I think that's where our guest is right now. It must be middle of the afternoon where you are, Chris.
That's correct, Jim. It's just gone 3 o'clock here, and the sun is shining.
Well, Richard Burton was a legendary figure on the screen and had a life off the screen that was well publicized. He died at 58 years old. We know of his tremendous voice and acting ability and command of the language, but he was also a prolific writer.
He was. He loved to write. He had ambitions, I think, to be a writer, perhaps more pronounced than to be an actor. And he kept these diaries, almost 400,000 words in total. And he tried to write most days for periods of years at a time.
Almost every day, right?
Almost every day for certain years. You know, there are huge gaps. I'm sort of quite thankful that he didn't write every day of his 58 years, because I have no conception of how long that would have taken me to edit. But between 1965 and 1972, he's keeping the diary fairly consistently. There are a couple of earlier diaries, and there are 3 later diaries as well. But the bulk of the writing is being done while he is married to Elizabeth Taylor for the first time.
Now, you meticulously edited the prose from Richard Burton. How difficult was it?
It wasn't very difficult in terms of understanding the prose. Some of the diaries are handwritten, and it's a question just of persevering, really, until you work out the handwriting. Quite a lot of them are actually typed, because Burton carried this portable typewriter around with him. So that's fairly straightforward. The challenge really is in the size of the work, nearly 400,000 words, and in the range of reference, personal place names, cultural references, books that he's been reading, film projects he's working on, all these kinds of things, having to work out who all these people are. I mean, some of them, Marlon Brando and so on, are fairly obvious, but then other people who might have had a lot to do with Richard, they might have been part of the entourage of Burton and Taylor, or they might have been having small parts in the films. It can take a little bit of detective work to identify these people.
Richard Burton's personal life was well documented, particularly his marriages to Elizabeth Taylor. They were married from 1964 to 1974, and then remarried in 1975, and then were split again in 1976. Much of that relationship, the ups and downs, the high points and lows, they're all detailed in his words.
They are. They are. It's a constant theme of Richard's adult diaries, that love he has for Elizabeth and the trials and tribulations of their marriage. And I think if you read the diaries, you will appreciate that this was a very genuine love that they shared. That Elizabeth comes out of the diaries, I think, very well as a very tender and loving and warm person. And, you know, this was a genuine match, I think, of two people who really loved each other and admired each other as well. But, of course, it wasn't an easy relationship. There were problems. They were both fairly hot-tempered. They both liked to drink. And ultimately, I'm afraid, it disintegrated. But, you know, 10 years in show business is perhaps not too bad for a marriage.
There's no doubt he thought she was the most beautiful woman on the planet, and she may have been, but yet some of his names for her were less than flattering.
Indeed, yes. Old Fatty was one. Snapshot, Quick Take. He liked to pull her leg. He would tease her about her double chin. supposedly, and she equally would respond by making comments about his the ravages that acne had left upon his the skin on his face. So they, you know, there was quite a lot of banter going on between them. I think it was good-natured, perhaps 75% of the time, and then the rest of the time it kind of degenerated into quarrels.
Did he appreciate how good he was on the screen?
I don't think Richard really understood why he'd been successful as an actor, either on stage or on the screen. I don't think he enjoyed watching films. He certainly avoided watching himself on the screen as much as possible. And he evinced a kind of disdain for acting as a profession. That comes through quite strongly in the diaries. He does not see it as a respectable profession for a man of his intelligence.
Here's some samplings. September 30th, 1967, at noon this same day, I did something beyond outrage. I bought Elizabeth the jet plane we flew in yesterday. It costs brand new $960,000. She was not displeased. That was a lot of money in 1967.
It was. I mean, of course, Elizabeth famously was getting paid $1 million for each film she made, and Richard wasn't too far behind in his earning power. So they had the money to throw around, but they spent it very lavishly on art, on jet planes, on yachts, on cars, on homes. They gave a lot of money away to charities, to family members, to friends. They spent a lot on jewelry. Elizabeth, of course, built up an enormous collection of very expensive of jewels. And so they lived life in the public gaze, and they spent money like water.
Another entry on June 15th, 1969. I awoke this morning at 7 o'clock. I stared at Elizabeth for a long time. I held her hand and kissed her very gently. Probably no woman sleeps with such childish beauty as my adorable, difficult, fractious, intolerant wife.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, I see Elizabeth Taylor on films now, and you just wonder, certainly in the 1960s, 1970s, she had an absolutely magnetic screen presence. I think she's more beautiful, actually, moving on films than she is in still life photography. So I think Richard sometimes couldn't believe his luck. You know, here he was, the son of a Welsh miner from a relatively impoverished background, and he'd ended up married to this most beautiful woman in the world.
Chris, you go back well before Elizabeth Taylor, back to when Richard Burton was a teenager, he was writing. 1940, the day the Germans launched their blitzkrieg in Western Europe, Richard Burton was writing in his diary, wasn't he?
He was, yeah. He keeps this diary as a schoolboy. And, of course, the Second World War is breaking out in Europe, and Richard's older brothers are getting called up. There are barrage balloons floating high in the sky above his hometown, and there are German bombing raids on South Wales. All of this is taking place. And at the same time, you've got this young boy who is interested in the outcome of the next rugby match that he's playing in, or he's trying, you know, he's swatting away at school, trying to improve his math average. So it's quite a vivid document depicting the world that Richard really grew up in.
A listener asks, how much did Richard Burton write about the breakup that Elizabeth Taylor had with the singer and actor Eddie Fisher as a result of filming Cleopatra with Mr. Burton?
Well, unfortunately, the diaries are not being kept by Richard during that period. So we only have Richard's reflections after the event on Eddie Fisher. He did not respect Eddie Fisher, I think it's fair to say, and he's very dismissive of him. He did respect Mike Todd, of course, Elizabeth's previous husband. He recognized, I think, that Mike Todd was a man of some substance, and I think Richard saw him as an equal. No, Eddie Fisher, he didn't have very much time for. And he doesn't like, I don't think, to write very much about that episode, partly because, of course, it also involved the breakup of his own marriage and his separation from his daughters.
He did make the comment cruelly to her at one point that if she would marry Eddie Fisher, she would marry anybody, right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And again, you know, I think that's part of the banter, the quite cruel banter that sometimes they indulged in. And Well, who's to know? I mean, you know, Eddie Fisher bounced back from that, of course, and enjoyed a successful career after Elizabeth, but it must have been an incredibly bruising experience for him, as well as a traumatic one for everybody else.
Now, after Elizabeth Taylor, Richard Burton married a couple of more times.
He did. He married Susie Hunt, who had been married to the racing driver, the Formula One racing driver, James Hunt. He married her in 1976. That was a very important marriage. I think Susie did a lot to rescue Richard from the brink of self-destruction. And they were together for about 6 years. And then I think essentially Susie became very unhappy with Richard's drinking, his continued alcoholism. And then Richard was with Sally Hay, and he married Sally in 1983, and she was his wife when he died in August 1984.
And by most accounts, he was happy with Sally at the time of his death.
I think he was, yes. I mean, there's been some speculation as to whether he was writing to Elizabeth Taylor, whether he was trying to get back to Elizabeth in some respect. I think that's largely smoke and mirrors, frankly. I don't think there's any serious evidence to suggest that Richard wanted to be reunited with Elizabeth. He was still very fond of Elizabeth, but I don't think they were going to be romantically linked again.
As you did noted, he was 58 when he died on August 5th, 1984. Did he know his life would be short?
I think he sensed that he would not live as long as his father, who lived into his late 70s. He had, of course, lived life at a very high pace, rather dangerously in terms of his health. I'm sure he didn't know that he would pass away before he was 60, and of course the end came very, very suddenly and unexpectedly. And so I suppose it's possible to speculate what kind of career he might have enjoyed had he lived just another decade, and also what he might have done with these diaries had he been able to reflect on them later in life. But there we are. He didn't have that opportunity.
Chris, you say that many readers will be surprised at how interested Richard Burton was in books and in scholarship.
Yes, that's correct. I think most people have an image of Richard, which is of a hard drinker, of a womanizer, as a very talented actor with a great voice, but who nonetheless kind of threw away his talent in an orgy of waste and self-destruction. There's some truth in all of that, but equally, you've got somebody here who is very, very well read, who takes an enormous interest in the world around him and is trying to keep up with the latest developments in literature. He's a great student of poetry. He's always trying to learn a foreign language. And, you know, there's an immense intellectual energy in Richard Burton that comes through in the pages of his diaries.
What are, in your estimation, Chris, what are his most vivid films?
Well, I think one of his most successful films is The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, where he disillusioned British agent Alec Lemus. I think another great film was The Night of the Iguana, based, of course, on Tennessee Williams's play. And he has a great screen presence there, and he's playing opposite Ava Gardner and Deborah Kerr and Sue Lyon. I think it's a great treat, that film. But even at the end of his life, Richard was still very capable of making extremely impressive films. I think the film of George Orwell's novel 1984, Richard plays the interrogator O'Brien. And again, you know, he's not the main role in that. That's John Hurt, but he's got a tremendous screen presence. And so, you know, Richard was capable of some stunning performances on film.
Thank you very much, Chris Williams. The Richard Burton Diaries.
On Talk of the Nation, we like to be clear about what we're talking about, whether it's movies.
A B-movie was a movie that was made specifically to be on the bottom half of a double feature.
Or the auto industry.
One mid-level executive at a top automaker told me, well, 30 years ago, we were a car company that would occasionally lend money to our customers, and now we're a bank that makes cars.
Talk of the Nation, clear, straight, open, from NPR News. Weekdays at 1 on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge.
Support for the Jim Inkster Show provided by Luba Workers' Comp. For over 20 years, Luba has provided workers' compensation coverage to businesses throughout Louisiana and now Arkansas and Mississippi. LubaWC.com. Luba Workers' Comp. Genuine dependability.
And by Archipelago. current upscale men's casual fashion specializing in brands like Peter Mylar and Mavi, Archipelago, at Town Center next to Cold Stone. Holiday gift ideas and gift cards available. ArchipelagoCollection.com.
This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Our guest at this time is Eric Deggans. His book is Race Baiter, and we will look at the landscape of media with Eric, who surveys it in his book. Gone is the era of Edward R. Murrow and Walter Cronkite. At that time, news programs gained the trust and respect of American viewers in a way that is much different from today's fast-growing news programs and media platforms. And good morning to you, Eric Deggans.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me.
Well, how has the landscape changed to the point where the information we receive and the prejudices that are inflamed have become an issue?
In the past, news operations and media outlets made money by getting together the biggest audiences that they could. So they were averse to material that would turn off segments of the audience or that would polarize people because they wanted to get big audience. Now that we're in the world of cable TV and satellite radio and so many internet platforms, you can't really get those big audiences except for things like professional football and huge events. So what you have to do is you target a niche of viewers, a big piece of them, and you do whatever you can to draw them in and also keep them with you and keep them from going to other places. So what you find is some media outlets use prejudice, and stereotypes, these sort of messages that demonize other groups in order to draw people to them and keep them from going to other places. And one of the examples I use in the book for is Fox News.
Well, the book is Race Baiter, How the Media Wields Dangerous Words to Divide a Nation, from Eric Deggans, who's a columnist with the largest newspaper in Florida, right?
That's right. Actually, we're the largest newspaper south of Atlanta. So, yeah.
And it's in the Tampa Bay Times.
The Tampa Bay Times, yeah.
Eric Deggans is a man who follows American life closely and has written about this issue regarding race. Why does Fox News fan the flames of race, or how does that network do it like others do not?
Well, I think one thing Fox does, obviously, it's very focused on conservative viewers. I always tell people you can judge the priorities of a cable news channel by just looking at who its biggest stars are. So if you look at Fox News, you see Bill O'Reilly, you see Sean Hannity, you see Megyn Kelly. Before he left, you saw Glenn Beck. All of those people are conservative-oriented, conservative-friendly. They focus on conservative topics. And if you look at opinion surveys, if you look at studies, you'll see that their audience is mostly middle class, mostly middle-aged and even older, and white. And so they're reflecting the concerns and the fears of that audience. And, of course, one of those fears is the effect of multiculturalism, the effect of sort of dealing with diversity initiatives, this concern that maybe white people are being displaced in the rush to do right by minority groups, that men are being displaced in the rush to do right by women. And, for example, the Brookings Institution did a study, and they found that about 46% of average people think that white people have the same problems with institutional racism as black people or people of color. But when you look at Fox News viewers, that proportion jumps to 70%. So that's a real concern for that audience, and they're just reflecting those fears back at them in a way that draws people to them. And then they also say, well, you know, we're the only news source you can trust. You know, everybody else is liberally biased. Everybody else is in the tank for Democrats or in the tank for liberal thought, so we're the only people you can trust. But in the process of delivering that message, it also degrades people's confidence in journalism in general, and it turns them against other people.
Now, MSNBC has become the counter to Fox and is presenting the news from a partisan basis on its cable channel. From the left, are there some similarities?
Well, I think there's similarities in that both of these channels are becoming more and more invested in a partisan worldview. And because of that, they have certain takes on certain issues. For example, death of Trayvon Martin, this 17-year-old kid, unarmed, who was shot dead by a Neighborhood Watch volunteer here in Florida. That became an international story, but MSNBC paid attention to it much sooner than Fox News did because of the implications of a black teen who was unarmed and seemingly minding his own business, killed by a Neighborhood Watch volunteer who was not black, and initially who people thought was white. And so the racial implications of the killing and this concern about the police's reluctance to prosecute the shooter, I think made MSNBC jump on the story much sooner, much more aggressively, and they identified with the slain teen and his family much more strongly than CNN or Fox News eventually would. And of course, Al Sharpton, one of the one of MSNBC's most visible figures, also became a spokesperson for the family. So for some time in March, he was sort of toggling between hosting a show on MSNBC and being a very visible personality on that channel, and also representing the family, collecting money for them at protest rallies and delivering these very fiery speeches calling for George Zimmerman, the man who killed Trayvon Martin, to be prosecuted by police, which is something that I don't think we've ever seen before in cable news, where a prominent anchor is also representing one of the people at the heart of one of the biggest news stories in the year.
Eric Deggans is the guest. His book is Race Baiter, and he has focused upon race in media, which he is an expert upon as the expert on as a columnist and writer with the Tampa Bay Times. Now, Eric, we live in a country that is divided in many ways. President Obama won the election earlier this month with a margin that now appears to be substantial, over 4 million votes. But yet at the same time, he only got around 40% of the white vote. Are the media following the national trends, or are the media leading the pack in causing the racial division and other divisions we have in this country to be more pronounced?
Yeah, well, that's kind of a chicken and egg question right there, I think. It's hard to separate, you know, what's causing something and what's reacting to something, because, as I've often said, media is a catalyst and a reflection of society. So it reflects some things that are going on, and then by reflecting those things, it also causes other things to happen. For example, Roger Ailes, the man who created Fox News. Now, I talk about him a little bit in the book, and I talk about his history. This is a guy who started out as a sharp 20-something producer of the Mike Douglas Show, if you remember that TV show a long time ago. Yeah, and he ran into Richard Nixon when Nixon was a guest on the show when he was gearing up to run for president a second time in the 60s. And after a conversation with Roger Ailes about the power of television, suddenly he hired this guy to head the media for his presidential effort. And since then, Roger Ailes has been involved with a lot of Republican presidential candidates, from Ronald Reagan to George H.W. Bush. And each one of those campaigns had some aspect where race was used in a way to gin up votes and separate out white voters. I mean, Richard Nixon was known for trying to appeal to whites who were felt disaffected by the Civil Rights Act in 1964, signed by Democrats. You know, Ronald Reagan was famous for talking about welfare queens. George H.W. Bush had the Willie Horton ad, where they used the exploits of an escaped black murderer to sort of demonize Michael Dukakis' stand on crime. And now we get to the point where he's creating the Fox News Channel, and he realizes that there's a huge core of older conservative news viewers who feel like CNN is not really reflecting how they see the world or the issues that they're interested in. So he creates a news channel that's focused on catering to how they see the world. And the next thing you know, that begins to perpetuate itself. And its stars go out and they create their own media platforms. So Sean Hannity has a radio show. Bill O'Reilly had a radio show and has books, and all of a sudden, you know, they're affecting society even while they're reflecting these ideas right back at their audience. So it becomes this vicious cycle in a way.
So what needs to be done, Eric Deggans, to change the landscape in which the media will not be preying upon the prejudices of its viewers and listeners and readers?
Well, you know, one of the things, one of the great, I think, successes of the civil rights movement is that we've reached a point now where open racism is generally looked down upon. You know, you can't, a white person can't walk up to a person of color and call them the N-word in polite company and expect that to fly. So we've reached a point where if you can take these messages that sort of work in the background, implicit messages, as they're called, and bring them into the light, you know, make people think about them consciously, make them explicit, then people often reject them. And I think, you know, the election results are one proof of that. There was a lot of attempts to sort of demonize Barack Obama in ways that seem centered on race and culture, trying to make him look like a radical when he really isn't. He's a centrist. Trying to make him look like he has some connection to scarier black political figures like Jeremiah Wright when he's severed his ties with him. And his policies have never really seemed to be connected to someone who's from that side of the aisle.
The book is Race Baiter, How the Media Wields Dangerous Words to Divide a Nation. Which form of media is most guilty of this?
I don't know that there's a form of media that's most guilty of it. I will say that media, again, that focuses on drawing pieces of the audience, so cable television, the internet, internet platforms, websites, things like that, they're most susceptible to it because they don't need to have a huge audience to make money. What they need to do is super serve a very narrow niche of viewers or readers or consumers. So if you're a broadcaster, if you're a network broadcaster, and you're trying to draw, you know, 10 million people or 15 million people to watch a weekly show, you can't really afford to put anything in that show that a huge number of people might find offensive. That's the struggle that network television has had to be more contemporary and to be more edgy and to be more groundbreaking. Every time they do that, they wind up putting things in the show, in their shows, that repel too many viewers. Now, in cable television, that's not a problem. So you can have a show like Mad Men that's very adult and very edgy and very in your face and very complex and hard to follow, and it only gets about 2 million viewers a week. But it makes money. It has a huge cultural influence. It's a huge enterprise because it's in cable television, where the niche of viewers matters a lot more than a big audience. So I think any platform that's focused on that kind of fragmented audience is susceptible to using these kinds of tactics to garner an audience.
Well, yeah, at times CNN and MSNBC have fewer than a million viewers at a given time at night. And Fox, a great night for Fox, is 3 million. It's not a large number when we're talking about over 300 million potential viewers in the United States alone. So it's a case in which it is niche marketing, no doubt about it. We live in a divisive world, and politicians often take advantage of that or try to. Here's an example, Eric Deggans, of Newt Gingrich a few weeks before the election, talking about the President of the United States.
I'm assuming there's some rhythm to Barack Obama that the rest of us don't understand, whether he needs large amounts of rest, whether he needs to go play basketball for a while. I don't watch ESPN.
Now, that was on Fox News. Now, what do you think of the remarks from Speaker Gingrich?
Well, you know, again, and this is the guy who gave us the food stamp president line. This is the guy who promised to go to the NAACP convention and convince the people there, who would mostly be African American, that they should demand paychecks instead of food stamps, as if people weren't already doing that. I mean, Newt Gingrich is the king of the code word, particularly in this last election cycle. and attaching these adjectives that suggest that Barack Obama is lazy, that he doesn't have the same work ethic as his competitor, that he needs more rest, particularly when he's involved in something that's intellectually challenging. Whether or not he meant these things to be prejudiced or stereotypical or even racist, they come awfully close to that line. So he should be aware of what he's doing, and he should be more careful about the words that he chooses. So whether or not he meant for what we just heard to sound like an exercise in prejudice, you know, given his history, given how many times he's come up to that line, given how what a gifted speaker he is and how long he's been famous, I've got to think that was on purpose. And particularly if it was on purpose, it was quite offensive.
Well, thank you, Eric Deggans. The book is Race Baiter, How the Media Wields Dangerous Words to Divide a Nation. Thank you, sir.
Thanks a lot for having me.
My pleasure. And now we are 3 weeks removed from the presidential election. It was 3 weeks ago today that Americans cast ballots. And the final popular vote is yet to be tallied. There are votes that are still coming in, and that's why now the president looks like he's going to get over 65 million votes. Got 69 million last time. And Mitt Romney now is getting close to a million votes more than John McCain received in 2008. But right now, the popular vote count is 64,817,072 for President Obama and 60,449,355 for Mitt Romney. That's a gap of 4,368,000 votes. This was not a close election. And for those who say the pollsters had it right, well, the final percentage, at least if it stands as it is now, Obama 50.8%, Romney 47.4%. That's 3.4% in the national voting. And I know of no polls on election eve or in the final week that had Obama 4 points ahead, and he may end up finishing, it looks like he will, about 3.5 points ahead of Mitt Romney. So it has turned into a relative rout. The only states that President Obama did not carry this time that he won in 2008 were Indiana and North Carolina. Today would have been the 70th birthday of a man who was born in Seattle on this date, November 27, 1942, as Johnny Allen Hendricks, better known as Jimi Hendrix. Jimi Hendrix, born on this date in 1942, died September 18, 1970 in London. He was 27 years old, as were Janis Joplin and Jim Morrison when they died. Jimi Hendrix died of an overdose. He was a U.S. Army veteran, 1961, 1962, and the preeminent guitar hero to emerge during the 1960s.
This is 89 RKF in Baton Rouge, your news, your culture. Engage with guests on the Jim Angster Show. Tweet at WRKF using the hashtag Jim Angster.
Support for WRKF provided by our members.
And by LSU School of Music a cappella choir's Candlelight Service, featuring medieval works and traditional carols with audience singing, accompanied by LSU's brass consort. Union Theater, Sunday, December 2nd, 7:30, music.lsu.edu.
And by Broadband IP, Baton Rouge's local internet provider for primary or backup internet connections for any size business. Broadband IP, 612-4207, on the web at broadbandip.net.
And by Taylor Clark Gallery, specializing in fine art, Audubon prints, and handmade custom framing for holiday gift giving. Taylor Clark Gallery, 2623 Government Street in Mid-City, and taylorclark.com.
This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. You may reach us via email at inkstershow@wrkf.org. We are talking now with James Lima. He is president of James Lima Planning and Development. It's an advisory firm focused on investments in the public realm and structuring public-private partnerships in real estate development. And James is in our city as part of the Smart Growth Summit, of which WRKF is a sponsor. And he is here to talk about development where he has been and some of the things that can be implemented in Baton Rouge. Good morning to you, James.
Good morning, Jim.
And by the way, James will be speaking tomorrow, Making Postcard Places, Infrastructure's Role in Economic Development. Postcard places. How do we do it?
Well, it starts with the notion that our workforce has become increasingly mobile. And so all places have become increasingly in need of having a competitive advantage. They need to compete for workers and residences. And because they're more mobile, because people are not staying in corporate jobs for 20, 30 years, they really are moving from place to place that have that essential quality of life attribute. And so what I focus on and what we're going to talk a lot about at the summit is how do places that are seeking to grow, that are seeking to revitalize, that are seeking to create jobs and economic prosperity, both in the short term and in a sustained, enduring way, how do they create plans and implement them and have leadership and governance structures in place that allow that to happen?
Now, James has served with New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg as founding president of the Governor's Island Preservation and Education Corporation. That organization oversaw the planning, redevelopment, and operations of a 172-acre former military facility in New York Harbor in conjunction with the National Park Service. That was an ambitious project. That's something that just can't be picked up and brought somewhere else. But what can be done along those lines in places like Baton Rouge?
You know, Jim, what's so interesting about a project like Governor's Island, which for 200 years was one of the most storied military headquarters facilities in America, every major general who served in the U.S. Army served there, including Ulysses Grant. Because it was a military facility, but it was 5 minutes offshore as its own island off Wall Street in New York Harbor. Dyed-in-the-wool New Yorkers knew nothing about it, had no opportunity to ever go there. I was fortunate enough to run a public development corporation that was charged with transforming a former military base into a public place that had parks and culture and education and civic uses. We had to figure out how to start. And I think the lesson learned there is using exciting programming, which can come right out of the box quickly, using cultural arts attractions, food attractions, music, and ways to reconnect with our waterfronts as ways to get people excited about a place that they haven't typically been before, maybe have never been before, and start to take some ownership of as an important and beloved public place. And so that's what we rolled out at Governor's Island, is a very ambitious cultural arts program that brought sculpture, that brought incredible international food events, that brought these ephemeral things that would come and go, whether it was music or creative programming. And those are things that Baton Rouge and other places are doing and should continue to do, because it's about enlivening the life of cities. And to the extent that you can have more feet on the street at more hours of the day and night, that's going to be your key to economic success. That's going to be the defining quality that will influence someone's decision to move there, to work there, to locate a business there, to go to school there, to come and spend an afternoon as a visitor shopping and the like.
297-5633 if you'd like to join the conversation with James Lima, architect, developer, and professor. Chad and Baker, good morning, Chad. You're on the air with James Lima.
Yes, good morning, Mr. Inkster, and also to your guests. This Smart Growth Summit is a wonderful thing that comes, I believe it comes every year, the Baton Rouge. But I would challenge those that are involved in the summit would please take a look at North Baton Rouge and not just focus so much as well as South Baton Rouge, because, and I, hopefully we could come up with some solutions to build public and private partnerships to target those communities that are, have blighted areas that need economic development, and also to look at many socially disorganized communities that need quality businesses. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Chad.
You know, it's a great point. I've spent most of my career working in community development and creating affordable housing at high quality in places where people said it wasn't possible. And it really is about partnerships. It's about getting a community vision, first and foremost, that becomes inevitable, that you've built so much public support, that you've invested enough in what a community wants and needs, but you've done it in a way that's grounded in market reality. You understand what the partners, the real estate developers, the banks, the foundations, the involved public agencies, what each of their authority is, what their bottom line is, their alignments of mission and interests, and then bring that together around that vision and figure out important strategic ways to implement the plan. And it really does start with having significant buy-in and having leadership. And I think the role of leadership is a recurring theme in smart growth. You can have fantastic, exciting plans that are visionary and very idealistic, but if you don't have leadership that's going to drive that train and move it forward and really bring a team together that has the capacity to both plan, develop, and then run and operate in the long term effectively, you're going to have difficulty. So it's as much about governance and leadership and implementation as it is about a community-driven vision process.
The guest is James Lima, and he is part of the Smart Growth Summit. He will be featured tomorrow afternoon at the Manship Theater. The Center for Planning Excellence is holding its 7th Louisiana Smart Growth Summit. It started last night and continues through tomorrow at the Manship Theater, downtown Baton Rouge. And the theme of this year's summit is Smart Growth is Smart Business. You live in New York City, don't you?
I do.
So how is that experience?
Well, I'm actually from a small, pretty coastal town in Rhode Island, and I came to New York at 17 for college. And really fell in love with the life of the city, and I've been there ever since. But I've seen a dramatic transformation since I arrived in New York in 1981, when there was enormous disinvestment and, a lot of abandonment of waterfront properties, in particular former industrial waterfronts, but even, chaotic conditions in Times Square. And then you fast forward 30 years and you see the extraordinary transformation, largely led by early patient public capital investment in the public realm. And that's what we're going to talk a lot about at the summit, is how do we both create the case to government for that early investment in infrastructure, which isn't just sewers and water mains and roads, but it's open space and parks and public places that become the organizers of future development and investment, that create gathering places and a quality of vibrant experiences that, again, make people choose those communities as the ones in which they want to live, work, study, play. So I look at an example of the High Line, which has become an enormously successful new linear park that runs through the west side of the Chelsea neighborhood of Manhattan. It was an elevated freight rail line that was a way to safely deliver goods to warehouses in the early 20th century on the west side of Manhattan, because trains used to run at grade and were killing pedestrians on the street. It was abandoned in the 70s, and for some 20 years, that elevated steel rail line was at risk of being demolished. Mayor Mike Bloomberg came in, and there had been some advocacy to say, let's keep it and let's transform it into a public park, a two-mile-long public park. The need for public funding up front was something on the order of $100 million. And the firm that I was, until recently, a partner in, did a really important economic analysis that said, and this is really applicable to municipalities all around the country, there is a compelling return on public investment by investing early in placemaking. In the case of the High Line, $100 million, actually $110 million of New York City capital funding invested early, 10 years ago, has created an entire new district identified as the High Line District. It has become one of the great park destinations in the world, with more than 3 million visitors shortly after the first year. And it became the organizer of almost $1 billion, of new condominiums, hotels, Class A office space, and restaurants, and cultural arts. And it was that argument that there's a return on public investment, that the property values around this park have increased because they have this beautiful front door of a park. And because property values have increased in front of that new park, they pay more real estate taxes. And that real estate tax revenue has been combined with increased spending by tourists who come now in ways that they didn't before to the neighborhood and to New York City. And so all told, the latest estimate is there's something on the order of $900 million in net present value gain to the city of New York from having invested that $100 million in that park. So that's an 800% return on investment by the public sector.
297-5633. James Lima is the guest. He is a developer and is justifiably proud of some of the work that he and his assistants and colleagues have done in New York City. Now, Mayor Michael Bloomberg has led the charge there, hasn't he?
He has. Under his predecessor, Rudy Giuliani, there was an impetus to actually tear down the High Line. It was seen as just a rusting hulk that was really getting in the way of development. I think a lot of people have looked at that project not as a literal example to follow, but one that created a vision at a district scale. So you think about a downtown. What's a vision for a whole downtown? What's a vision for a linear waterfront, whether it's the St. Louis Arch, or the vision to take down a stretch of the highway that blocks Seattle's downtown from its waterfront in ways that Austin and other cities are looking at their waterfronts and working on a project in South Florida similar. You know, how do you reclaim those public places, many of them previously industrial, as a public realm that becomes a very attractive new node of economic growth? In some cases, not just for leisure and recreation, but attracting new drivers of the economy, what I call the eds and meds, the academic institutions and the medical centers that even in weak market locations cannot be exported. They are there. They are the things that are left behind, and they are the major employers and centers. And they're experiencing significant growth in life science, in biotechnology, in applied science. So how can a knowledge economy become an important element of placemaking, and how to create those attractions that create jobs?
Quelly in Sherwood. Good morning, Quelly. You're on with James Lima.
Good morning, gentlemen. How are you today?
Fine.
As the previous caller pointed out, in our inner cities, there's a terrible need for this type of development. My question is, being from New York, do you find that there's a cultural difference with the culture in New York than it is here in the South? And if so, what are the obstacles that you have to overcome to spurn that type of growth and development here in the South? Because our mindset is terribly different than what it is from the North.
Well, I'm happy to be here in Baton Rouge, but it is my first time
visiting here.
So I'm looking forward to getting to know the city more. But, I understand your point, and, these are long-seated issues that need to be addressed, and I think social equity is certainly an important one. My experience in working extensively in the South Bronx and in Harlem and in old distressed port cities like New Bedford, Massachusetts, which have very high levels of poverty, is that everybody essentially wants the same thing. So how do we get opportunities to be made available to everyone, both as a civic community that comes together in attractive places, but, you know, obviously there are bigger public policy issues around education, public safety, you know, quality of life, housing choices, housing affordability, job creation, job readiness. I think what we're talking about is let's try to create transit-oriented, walkable places that are both mixed use and mixed income so that all groups of people have the opportunity to live simpler, higher quality ways of life, less dependent on cars, which are expensive and have many costs. And, you know, how do we use the tools that are available, municipal bonds, tax credits, and the proven methods that are available nationally that involve all partners, government, foundations, private investors, tax syndicators, to come together around community redevelopment. And I think, you know, I would be encouraged to look at national models for inclusion and to just highlight those best practices and try to apply them and to apply the political pressure to say, you know, why not? Why can't we strive for this?
James, of the place? James Lima just arrived last night in Baton Rouge. First impressions?
I had a late dinner in downtown Baton Rouge, and it was a beautiful night, and I walked around the old state capitol and City Hall, and, you know, I could see how significant the investments have been in recent years, and it's really paying off. There was a really impressive sense of a place and a mix of uses that, you know, leverages the assets you have. And I think that's another really important message. Wherever you are, don't try to be something you're not. Look at the things that you have that are your strengths. And part of why I often am asked to come into a community is that you come with a set of fresh eyes.
Well, tomorrow at 3:55 at the Manship Theater, you can hear James Lima, Making Postcard Places, Infrastructure's Role in Economic Development. And tomorrow we will also feature another person involved with the Smart Growth Summit as a speaker and authority, Robin Rather, who is the daughter of Dan Rather. So until then, for Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.